This is something that we also need to educate. What does a digital trust role look like? Where does it sit in the organisation? Who does it report to? What is its function? Should we not also be perhaps ensuring that this information is also on standing committees of board, like the Audit and Risk Committee, and should that not be reporting up board about the need for digital trust and digital trust practices within the organisation?
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Joining me today is Joe Stewart-Rattray, Isaka Oceania Regional Ambassador, and today we're talking about Isaka's recent report, State of Digital Trust Annual Research, and as well as your recent visit to New York to attend the United Nations Conference around the status of women. We'll be linking the report in the show notes, so if you want to go and dig a little bit deeper after our interview, then we will, of course, be linking that. So, Joe, thank you so much for joining me back on the show. I think this is your third or fourth time now back on the show.
Third or fourth, I'm not sure either, but it sort of feels good.
And I want to start perhaps with your recent visit with UN. Tell me all about it.
This gathering is of all member states. So all 193 member states of the United Nations get together and look at a particular theme in relation to gender equality across the world. This year's theme was in relation to the empowerment of women and girls through the use of technology and innovation, and indeed looked at some of the issues that are also faced by women and girls. I was very lucky to be, I wear many hats. And one of those hats is that I am also, as well as being involved with Isaka, I'm also the Vice President of Communities for the Australian Computer Society. It was the Australian Computer Society who sponsored my trip with a colleague to the UN to take part in the Commission on the Status of Women so that we could bring back all of the learnings that we had and then, of course, operationalize them in the Australian context. Some of the things that we discovered that were really alarming is that, AI is definitely changing our world, but there are issues around people becoming nothing more than a data point. So dehumanization is a real issue. Also, bias in development of AI is a problem, particularly bias against women and girls and people of color. Because, algorithms, which is how AI operates, is often based on the person that is writing it will inadvertently write bias into algorithms. And so therefore we end up with a problem at the end of the day. This could probably be changed significantly if there were more women involved with the creation of AI right from the beginning. At the moment, we're seeing that it's something like 1 in 5 workers in AI are women. And given that women represent 51% of the world population, you can see there's a disparity there for a start. There are also a range of other issues that are faced. If we look at the member states themselves, we can see that at least $1 trillion is being left on the table every year because of women not being included in the workforces and indeed not being involved in technology right from the get-go as well. So what happens is the member states come together, they discuss these particular elements from the Secretary General's report, which finds its way into what's called Agreed Conclusion Zero draft. And that's what is negotiated by the diplomats. I was very lucky to be part of the Australian contingent where I was actually adding language, if you like. And when we talk about language, we're talking about concepts into the Australian government contribution to the agreed conclusions. And those agreed conclusions, as I say, each clause in the agreed conclusions must be agreed by all 193 member states to give us a roadmap for the next 6-year cycle. And that's a roadmap for the nations around the world to be able to be held accountable to. And the interesting thing is each year they come back and they talk about where they are up to in relation to the theme. And so in that regard, we see nations actually holding one another to account, which is a really interesting approach. There are some nations who are further down the track than others, but we still have a very thorny issue, as the Secretary General pointed out, is that parity and equity or equality for women has actually gone backwards in the last couple of years since the beginning of the pandemic. We had been sitting at a point where we won't reach gender equality until our granddaughters, granddaughters, granddaughters are in the picture. And that worked out to be about 200 years. We're now at 0.300 years, which I think you will agree is pretty shocking. And so, you know, I think we need to be looking at how we locally can take the learnings that we've had and move the needle on diversity and inclusion in the tech workforce.
Yeah, wow. Okay, that's a very interesting observation. Personally, what were some of your biggest takeaways from your trip?
That's actually a really difficult question. But I think the one takeaway that I always have, and this is my third time in person at CSW, our contributions, no matter how small, actually make a difference. And one of the things I always walk away from CSW with is the feeling that what we're doing is potentially working towards helping millions of other women across the world, and indeed women here in Australia more particularly. So that's always my takeaway, is what we are doing does make a difference. I heard an environmentalist say, every little bit makes a difference. So every little becomes a large when they're put together. And to me, that's the important thing, is that we can change the way things happen just in our own sphere of influence. And we all have a sphere of influence. And that might be about changing up the language that people use. We don't talk about manpower. We talk about resourcing. Just little things like that to make people aware of how they're speaking and how that might come across to others. That's kind of a trivial example, but it's one that I can think of off the top of my head. So that to me is really important, is that we do, and we call out behavior that is inequitable and that is perhaps somewhat misogynistic. And the only way that we do this sort of work is by standing shoulder to shoulder with our male allies. To me, it's really important that we don't just think that we can take this on and do it ourselves. We actually, it has to be a broader across civil society to make a difference. Look at how technology plays that critical role with innovation in achieving gender equality. We need to make sure that we do ensure that both the good, the bad and the ugly are addressed. So we need to look at not just the positive side, but what can we do to take the bias out, for instance? What can we do to ensure that women are a part of the development process as well? And we see that, you know, AI is shaping our world moving forward, but we only see, unfortunately, that one in five people working in AI are women. So we need to be encouraging people into STEM careers that will allow them to help form that future for us. And I guess another takeaway for me was that in 111 countries, it could be determined there were CIOs, only 11% of women. You know, that's kind of scary as well for me. And attrition rates for tech-related tertiary studies remains incredibly high. Again, something that we need to do. We need to do something about. And only 57% of women globally have connectivity. And this is the really scary one, Carissa, and I know that you'll be all over this one. More than 38% of women globally have personally experienced online violence.
Wow. When you say online violence, you mean like harassment, cyberbullying?
Yep, all of that.
Wow. In a business sort of setting or just personally?
All settings. We're talking about all settings. Because we talk about women in all their diversity. So when we're talking about women in all their diversity, we're talking about anybody who identifies as a woman. And we also are referring then to any of the settings in which she might work as well, work or be active in.
Wow, that's crazy. 37% you said?
Yep, that's right.
What would be some of your observations around that? Like, was that higher than you anticipated, or did you not really think about it maybe before?
I had thought about it before. I recognised that there was a significant number of women that were experiencing that, you know, experiencing online gender-based violence, but I was a little stunned that it was quite that high. But then when I started to talk to colleagues and friends afterwards, it was clear that, you know, a lot of people also have not only been in the middle of all of that, but have chosen to ignore. I mean, I had a cyber stalker for a period of time myself. So you sort of, it almost becomes normalized. It's something that, oh my gosh, here we go again. You know, so I think we have to actually push back as women as well on that.
When you say push back, what do you mean by that?
We have to hold the perpetrators accountable. And I actually believe that we have to also hold the platforms on which these acts of violence accountable.
I definitely hear your point in what you're saying. But the argument is from the other side is, oh, well, it's, well, I'm just expressing my opinion. Now, that's, I think, how a lot of these large tech companies can get away with. Now, obviously, there's extreme levels of things, but if someone's just, in their mind, casually bullying someone.
But there is no such thing as casual bullying. If you bully someone, you bully someone. People take their own lives as a result of bullying.
I am in agreement with that. It's just more so that's how these tech companies try to circumvent being held accountable by saying, oh, but it's their opinion.
Is it right that they're allowed to get away with it? I mean, you know, this could actually cause harm. And this is what I think platforms need to be aware of, is that this behavior can cause harm. I've just made that statement that people take their own lives as a result of continuing bullying online, or indeed gender-based violence online. So, you know, is that acceptable to say, oh, it was just somebody expressing their opinion where that has been the outcome, the loss of a life? And what about the cause of the loss of that life to that family who can never reconcile what has happened? People's lives are ruined as a result of this stuff.
Most definitely. I think they just try to wash their hands clean of it. Like, well, it's not our problem. Like, we can't control what everyone says. So how would you recommend to hold people accountable? And I do hear what you're saying, and I understand the suicide rates due to people being bullied online. I do understand that. What can we do? Because then I think a lot of them fall back to, well, those are our terms. Like, for example, like, I understand their reasoning because they're like, oh, well, you've come on the platform, then don't be on the platform. And but that doesn't really solve the issue either. But I'm just curious to know, like, how can we keep people accountable? Like, what do we need to do?
That's almost like saying it's the woman that's broken. She's the one that's got the problem, not this environment in which we're operating in. And quite frankly, I don't think women are broken. I think sometimes the system may break them, but it also breaks men as well. But I think that why shouldn't women be able to go online and feel safe online? That was a whole part of the discussion and certainly came through in the Secretary General's report as well. That really important that women feel safe, empowered to go online and to be safe when they're online. That's the bit about holding people accountable to it. You know, it's about fixing a broken system, isn't it?
How can we move the needle? Because, okay, so just say in a year's time, you may not meet up with the United Nations again. Is it going to be the same sort of, this is a problem, we report on it, but then nothing gets done? Like, will things start to progress?
Well, no, it's interesting because the agreed conclusions that we come to, hopefully, if all 193 member states agree to every single paragraph that is written, we have these agreed conclusions, and they're the roadmap by which countries hold one another accountable. So it gives member states the roadmap as to how they need to move forward on gender equality. So it will take a look at, next year it will take a look at a different component of equality and deal with that whilst the member states are reporting back on what they have done against this year's theme. And so they also hold one another accountable, as I said. So that's an interesting point. It's really about putting a focus on prioritising digital equity in order to close the gender digital divide, because that's really causing a problem. So one of the things we can do is it's not just about educating women and girls. It's also about educating parents that it's all right for girls to be in STEM careers, you know, to do STEM study and to be in STEM careers, because, you know, some parents are actively, I have heard, have been actively dissuading their daughters from going into STEM study and STEM careers because of this lack of equity and because of the gender pay gap.
So I'm going to switch gears now, Joe, and discuss the state of the Digital Trust annual report. Now, I believe a year ago you came on and you spoke about the report, so I can't believe a whole year's gone by already. But I want to start with one of the highlights was that 29% plan to increase budgets in the next year to achieve digital trust. So how do people increase digital trust when more budgets are allocated to doing so? Like how do people do that?
I think first of all, if we go to the nub of this, I think there has to be a real understanding of what digital trust actually means, that this is not something that sits purely with IT or with security. This is something that is a whole of business approach. So I think that's how we make this work, is that we get an approach across an organization to make sure that there is an understanding that in every transaction that we do, there's an element of trust required. Now, that's the same as in person, but we have to really, in this case, look at the digital elements about that. You know, 29% is less than a third. So that's why I think that we need to educate people, because 99% of people said that digital trust is important. Well, if it's important, why are only 29% looking to increase their budgets? I would be actually asking also, how many organizations have budgets for digital trust? Or are they hidden in something else? So, you know, this should go from procurement, legal, all the way through the organization. The other thing that we need to think about too is the fact that there are most organizations don't have a digital trust role. Only 13% have a digital trust role within the organization. So to me, this is something that we also need to educate. What does a digital trust role look like? Where does it sit in the organization? Who does it report to? What is its function? Should we not also be perhaps ensuring that this information is also on standing committees of board, like the Audit and Risk Committee? And should that not be reporting up board about the need for digital trust and digital trust practices within the organization?
So today we spoke last year about digital trust. Would you say that this is more of a focus this year, according to businesses, or like, have you seen any massive delta over like last year versus this year?
I guess the thing was that 18% of board directors have made digital trust a priority. But again, I'd like to understand how they have made it a priority. Is that 18% in the same 29% that are looking to increase budgets? Because oftentimes there has to be the right tone at the top, and it has to be driven down through organisations. So I'm hoping that this actually means that there is a greater awareness at board level, and that we'll see greater increases when it comes time to have this discussion next year.
Maybe press on that a little bit more. So when you say digital trust as a priority, is there anything specific, like, okay, you can come out and say, okay, we see digital trust as a priority, and then allocating the budgets. But is there anything more that would sort of imply that they're taking digital trust a little bit more seriously and they're putting a focus on it? Is there anything else that you can maybe add to that?
Well, you know, it's about assurance, isn't it? It's about understanding what levels of trust are in your organisation and between organisations that you deal with as well. So, you know, it's not just you and the world by yourself out there. It's about those organisations that you deal with as well. It's about holding them also accountable, again, just as we do in the security world.
Do you mean so from a supplier perspective?
Yes, suppliers or other organisations that you might deal with, whether it be a consulting practice or suppliers or, you know, so that's why I say it's a whole of business approach, because you need to get your procurement team on side with you as well to ensure there's a level of trust with those people that you deal with. Who are they? How do they operate? Do they have any level of integrity? Do they understand the trust, the business that they do as well?
So would you say that procurement teams are being a little bit more pickier with their suppliers that they bring on board to be in line with the digital trust vision that some of these organisations are putting a focus on?
Well, I think procurement's a really hard place to be at the moment because they've got so many competing demands. Yes, the digital trust experience. There's the security piece. There's the privacy piece. There's conflicts going on that's causing an issue in that world. There's also modern slavery. So, I mean, I really would not like to sit in position of a senior procurement officer because of all of those competing interests that they have to give a level playing field to. But I think if you look at them all holistically, you can say that digital trust plays a part in most of them. So if you look at it again in that holistic, because I'm a great one for whole of business approach. So if you can do it in that holistic manner, then I think that's a really great starting place.
So then the next stat that I sort of derived from the report was that 22% of organizations measure digital trust among customers. How are they effectively doing this? Is it through surveys? Is it through calling customers up? Or how are they doing that?
You know, how many times do you actually get surveyed? I mean, I know that I'm suffering a little bit of survey fatigue these days. That calling a customer up, whilst it's a lovely personal approach, think about the scams we get as well. So people are a little bit loath to give too much information over the phone if they're not expecting that call.
Yeah, totally. I do hear what you're saying. When you spoke before around, you know, not calling people up, I don't think I've ever been called up ever about getting feedback. I get lots of emails, but I don't really answer the emails unless it was super bad.
Yeah, no, the interesting thing is though, you'll often be on a call if it's a call center, and they'll say, would you mind hanging on for just another couple of seconds and answer three questions? That's another way of doing it, right? So if you're already having that interaction with the organization, they'll ask you, just hold the, if, do you mind holding the phone for like, you know, another couple of minutes just to answer three questions? And I don't actually have an issue with that because I've obviously, it's a fair dinkum transaction that I've done with that organization.
So out of that 22%, how would you say customers are measuring that digital trust? Like, what is it specifically? They're like, oh yes, you're trusted to us as a customer.
That is a really hard question to answer. Do you trust the transactions you have with that organization? You know, I might say absolutely 100%, but you might say, oh, my experiences haven't been so good. But I can tell you that one of the things that organizations have found is that it's really good for them to be able to have some sort of independently graded approach to trust practices and then allow those results to be made public. So in other words, to do an assurance review across there, and that might be getting an independent organization to do those reviews for you. In the digital trust survey, we found that 66% believed it was really important for organizations to be graded independently on their digital trust practice.
Well, I think that makes sense, or else then you're sort of feeling self-fulfilling prophecy then. So it is good to have an external, you know, consultancy, whatever it is, to grade you. So it's a little bit more of an objective opinion. We spoke last year about the report. How does this report sort of stack up against last year's report? Did anything sort of surprise you?
I was a little bit alarmed about some of the obstacles. It seemed to be the same sort of obstacles we see around security and privacy, et cetera. So, you know, lack of finance for skills and training, lack of leadership buy-in, and how often have we heard that, you know, in the past in various areas. And lack of alignment of digital trust with enterprise goals. But I actually think we can do that. We can actually make those two cascade and align. And of course, lack of budget and lack of tech resources, that's always one that we see. And digital trust in some organizations not being seen as a priority. Well, you know, you're always going to have those who are really early achievers and early adopters and who will go for it. And you'll always have those who won't. So I think that to me is not surprising to see that sort of six of one and half a dozen of the other. But I was sad to see that we have those same obstacles that we see with security and privacy. Lack of budget for skills and training and leadership buy-in and alignment with enterprise goals.
I've heard this stuff the last decade almost. Do you think that'll start to change? Or do you think in a decade's time when we're having this conversation, it'll change or will be the same lack of budget again?
I would like to think so, but you're right. You know, I've been in security for more than 20 years. And I have to tell you, it's a story that I've heard over and over and over those 20. So I would certainly hope that if you and I were having this discussion, and even 5 years, we would see a difference that people, given what the environment in which we're living, the major breaches that we've seen in this part of the world in the last less than 12 months, surely there has to be an understanding that digital trust is really important given all of those factors. And again, when we look at that, we have to look at it as holistically because it's the people part of this. There's the business part of it and there's the technology part of it. So, you know, that's not an unfamiliar story either.
Yeah, I know. That's so true. Well, I'm always like to think very positively. I like to be optimistic, not pessimistic. So hopefully in even 5 years' time, even 1 year's time, I mean, probably not if I'm realistic, but 5 to 10 years, I like to hope that these challenges that are in this report definitely changes that narrative. But you're saying the last 20 years and I'm saying the last 10, 11, which doesn't give me much hope.
I think we have to have hope because I think that's the only way that we can get this stuff done is by standing firm on this stuff and making it very clear that this is really important. A lot of this that we're talking about is really about almost going into civil society. It's pretty much like when we were talking about the UN experience as well, right? You know, that's the combination of civil society impost on the world. And that's what we're talking about here. You know, we're talking about that combination.
Well, Joe, it's always interesting having you respond on all your trips that you do and all the reports that you know to a very minutiae level. So I genuinely appreciate that. And I always appreciate you coming back on the show, considering it's been 3 or 4 times.
That's right. My pleasure. It's always great talking with you, Carissa. And I love the fact that you always have a different look at some of these things. You know, it's not the traditional look, and I really appreciate that.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by MercSec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit MercSec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to kbi.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.